Good morning. You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM. This is Tales of Entomology, your favorite show about insects and history. I've been waiting all week for this. I'm Martin, a wannabe entomologist.
And I'm Lucy, a medieval historian. And today's show is about climate, insects, and crop protection. We'll talk about the impact of the climate crisis on agriculture and on insect populations, as well as pesticides and their consequences on insects. But first, let's talk a little bit about climate.
Il fait chaud, ça sent le fantôme, le swing, le fumier.
So you got the theme. So let's talk about climate and weather, which might seem a bit far from entomology at first glance, but we'll connect it all soon enough. Lucy, what's the difference between weather and climate?
Well, weather refers to the regular atmospheric changes that we can see and feel in our daily lives. It rains, it's sunny. But the long-term atmospheric changes that occur over centuries are known as climate. So weather is really about right now and today, while climate refers to trends in weather that are almost invisible from our daily perspective. It's about decades and centuries.
And a lot of global warming deniers argue, with reason, that climate has varied far more dramatically in the Earth's past than anything going on today. It's true, and we'll talk about it soon. But unlike previous changes in climate, the current crisis is fueled by human activities.
Yes, previous warming episodes were triggered by increases in how much sunlight reached the Earth's surface. Warming then amplified by releases of carbon dioxide from the oceans as they warmed. But the current climate crisis is different. Today's warming is overwhelmingly due to the burning of fossil fuels by humans.
And researchers argue that over the last five decades, natural factors might actually have led to a slight cooling of Earth's surface temperatures. Global warming is also different from past climate changes in its rate. It is occurring much faster than at any point in the past 11,000 years or so, and probably faster than any other warm periods of the last million years.
And the other periods of climate change, either cooling or warming, eventually reversed as naturally as they had occurred. So the current warming can only be stopped if we drastically reduce the emission of carbon dioxide and other pollutants. But before talking about the impact of global warming and of the climate crisis on crops and insects, let's briefly talk about past changes in climate.
Right. So, the medieval climatic optimum, which everyone's heard about, is also known as the little climactic optimum or the medieval warm period. It refers to a period of time during which temperatures in Europe and the North Atlantic are believed to have been comparable to those of the late 20th century. This period occurred from approximately 900 to 13,000.
The medieval climatic optimum...
1300, sorry.
Yes, so from 900 to 1300. The medieval climatic optimum was only a feature of the North Atlantic and Europe. The cause could have been increased heat transported by the Atlantic Ocean circulation, which warmed, thus, the North Atlantic and Europe. And the temperature rose by 1.5 degree.
Right, and agriculture was possible at higher latitudes and higher elevations in the mountains than what is currently possible in many regions. Grapes grew in England several hundred kilometers north of their current limits of growth. Fig and olive trees grew in northern Italy and in parts of Germany well north of their current range. Winters in Europe were less severe and summers sunnier.
Some of the most compelling evidence for medieval warmth come from Iceland and Greenland. In Greenland, the Norse settlers arriving around the year 1000 maintained a settlement, raised dairy cattle and sheep. Greenland existed as a thriving European colony for a few centuries. During the medieval climatic optimum, a series of political reorganizations and technological advances led to an increase in food production and a demographic explosion. You might wonder, though, how do we know about past climate?
Well, that's a good question, and important to know, especially if we're going to argue for today's climate change. The reconstruction of pre-modern climate relies on two types of data, natural and man-made. And within these categories, there are direct and indirect observations available. Following? Man-made data, archival documents, archaeology, pictorial representations, etc. Climatic phenomena that are observed and measured, such as there was a hailstorm in Paris in March 1204, or in London in December 1314, there was up to 2 feet of snow. And then there's natural data. This is where science comes in. That's based on the analysis of organic objects and remains from the past.
This include, among others, a dendrochronology, which is the comparative study of annual growth tree rings. There is also fossil pollen comparison, animal, trees and plant remains of fossils, ice core samples, to only cite a few. And the combination of data sets from science and from the analysis of archives is central to the reconstruction of past climate. And the strength of one method do compensate for weaknesses in other method.
And what these methods have told us is that the medieval warm period was not comparable to the current climate crisis. First, the medieval warm episode was only centered on Europe and in the North Atlantic. And within that region, there were differences across time and space. Second, temperature rose, but less significantly than today. Europe gained 0.5 to 1 degrees, some say 1.5 in England, in the space of 300 years. Right now, a gain of 1.5 degrees in the next couple of decades is the most conservative estimate of global warming.
Global warming poses a threat to agriculture and will probably cause a global food crisis. Linked to this forthcoming food crisis are the consequences of global warming on insects' population. In the case of insects that damage crops, global warming is actually a boon.
Yeah, they're really happy about it. Monoculture provides an uninterrupted food supply, and warmer weather will extend the duration of the insects' feast on the crops. Warmer winters reduce insect mortality, and we are already seeing expanded pest ranges as northern regions warm.
Climate scientist Curtis Deutsch and others have argued in a 2018 paper published in the Science magazine that with global warming, insects will devour more and more crops.
They say that insects already consume 5 to 20% of the main grain crops, wheat, rice, and maize, that is, corn.
And they argue that yield lost to insects will probably increase by 10 to 25% per degree Celsius of warming in temperate regions where most grain is produced.
Crop losses will be most acute in areas where warming increases insect population growth and the insects' metabolic rates. So how will warmer temperatures impact insect populations? Well, insects' behavior is in large part driven by temperatures. With milder and warmer weather, insects start breeding earlier, they lay eggs earlier, which also hatch earlier.
Warmer temperature could add between 1 and 5 additional insect life cycles per season, meaning that insects would reproduce at a faster pace and in larger numbers. Moreover, Deutsch and his colleagues say in the science paper that warmth and heat bolster the insect metabolism, making them hungrier. That means that they would eat more crops.
Right. In the U.S., 15% of the current maize and wheat yields are lost to insects. With a 2-degree increase of Earth's surface temperature, insects' damage would make a loss of 20% of yields, amounting to nearly 20 tons.
In France, insect damage to wheat would augment by 60% due to global warming. But The same study from the magazine Science contends that in some already warm climates, such as in Southeast Asia, insect populations have already reached their full potential. So the rise in temperature would actually damage the insects themselves, leading them to decline in number in already very hot climates.
It's a very complex system. The climate crisis has a number of other impacts on insects. In a nutshell, the change in ecosystems will allow some insects to reach extreme populations while driving others to extinction.
First, we know that bird populations and bat populations, which feed on insects, are on the decline and at very frightening rates. So a number of insects are seeing their predators disappear and might in turn survive in larger numbers. One example of such are mosquitoes. An exploding mosquito population will pose serious health issues. You can just listen to our malaria episode to know that.
Right. Second, due to warming, some insects will exceed their traditional range and conquer new territories. Some are more invasive and destroy other insect populations, leading to a decline in biodiversity.
Three, the issue with growing populations of certain insects and migration to northern areas is that they threaten to profoundly modify the ecosystem. An example of such is the mountain pine beetle, a type of beetle traditionally found in the US Rockies. The species is also endemic in British Columbia, but until the 1990s, cold snaps and cold winters usually kept the population low by killing a number of eggs and larvae. The mountain pine beetle lay their eggs under the bark of trees, eventually cutting off water flow and nutrients.
When beetle populations are low, trees are able to suppress an attack by producing a toxic resin. But as more beetles come to a healthy tree, its natural defenses are overwhelmed and the tree eventually dies. Mountain pine beetles are now found in the boreal forest hundreds of kilometers northwards of their traditional range.
And beetle populations grow when summers are warm and winters are mild. They lay havoc in the forests. They have destroyed half of the commercial volume of lodgepole pine in BC alone over the past three decades.
So, we know that climate change threatens the survival of some fragile insect species, but climate change could also benefit a number of other species, such as mosquitoes that thrive in warm climates, and also insects that feed on crops, on trees, and on other plants. Of course, international companies that produce and sell pesticides say this issue can be solved by using more pesticides.
Sounds like a great idea.
Terrific.
But about 30% of global emissions leading to climate change are attributable to agricultural activities, including, but not solely, pesticide use.
Not only that, but pesticides contribute to the degradation of biodiversity, to pollution of soils and water resources.
Insects that are essential to restoring and maintaining ecosystems are actually under major threat due to the heavy and wild use of pesticides. And before talking about that, let's just take a short break.
Hi. I'm Martin, an entomologist.
And I'm Lucy, a medieval historian. Tune in every Monday at 2 p.m. to listen to us chatting about insects and history.
It's the real bee's knees. Don't miss the first half hour, or you'll miss the show.
And we're back on CGLO 1690 AM, and we hope you loved the show promo, because it was ours.
Why would you? That was a selfless, shameless.
It was shameless. So we were talking about quite a dramatic topic. So insects that are essential to restoring and maintaining ecosystems are actually under major threat due to the heavy and wild use of pesticides. Obviously, as soon as humans started farming, they had to protect their crops from hungry insects. And until the invention of modern pesticides and insecticides, various recipes and compounds were used to repel insects.
Now, first, there's a point we need to address. There seems to be confusion today when marketing companies oppose chemicals to natural products and associate these natural products with healthy in an attempt to greenwash their brand. A chemical is a substance consisting of matter. So pretty much everything on Earth is a chemical, such as oxygen or wine.
Or humans.
Or humans. Some highly toxic chemicals are natural products.
So the real problem with chemicals here with pesticides is really their impact on human and animal health, on the quality of soils, and on the quality of water. On the other hand, some argue that without modern fertilizers and pesticides, we could not feed the globe and human societies could not have exited the Dark Ages.
But pre-modern crop protection pretty much corresponds to what organic farmers do today, which is use very few products. First, there is the mechanical removal of pests, and by mechanical, I mean by hand. Children were put to work, as they should be, and asked to pick up snails, grasshoppers, and other bigger insects and non-insects from crops.
In terms of pesticides themselves, early modern farmers used products such as sulfur, pitch, and ashes, or lead, some of which are substances that are still found in organic agriculture today to prevent pest infestation, and that is especially the case for sulfur.
Which was spread in a thin powder as the base of the crops to drive at the base of the crops to drive away insects. It was burnt and fumigated around vegetable beds to repel ants and other pests.
Some of the products pre-modern farmers used were actually very dangerous. In one treatise on agronomy, the author recommended to pulverize lead on trees and vines to repel caterpillars. And also a well-liked natural pesticide was a one-year-old pigeon manure known to drive away vermin such as locusts and caterpillars.
Yet, farmers preferred to use botanical pesticides that were derived from plants. Garlic was, for instance, used to repel caterpillars and vines, mashed garlic, and to frighten wasps through fumigation. Garlic has sulfur compounds, making it a relevant plant to use in this case. Poisonous plants were also used, such as poison ivy. The branches of the ivy rich with leaves were affixed at the bottom of grapevine stems to drive away ants and beetles.
Mixtures were frequent, in which sometimes salt was added, or urine, or vinegar. I'll read a small quote by agronomist Ibn al-Awwam, who lived in the south of Spain in the 12th century. He wrote, "Wetting fruits, trees, and grapevines with rancid urine and dissolved dog poop will preserve them without damage." Pre-modern farmers did their best to prevent their crops from pests, and of course, they had mixed results.
A lot of famines and food shortages occurred in the past, mainly due to weather or diseases that impacted certain species of plants. Better knowledge of plants, insects, and the development of science from the late 18th century onwards led to tremendous advances in agronomy and in agriculture. They also came at a high cost, the mass extinction of insect populations.
Pesticides is a term that encompasses three types of products. Herbicides, which kill weeds, fungicide, that kill fungus or other organisms that could cause disease to crops, and insecticides, that kill insects. Modern pesticides are all synthetic. The first and most infamous of them is DDT. So that stands for, with my French accent, dichlorodiphenyltrichloroethane. Well, which we mentioned in our show about mosquitoes and malaria.
The molecule was synthesized in the late 19th century, but its action on insects was only discovered in 1939 by Swiss chemist Müller. Müller was actually who actually won a Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine in 1948 for discovering that DDT was an effective insecticide. Müller especially showed that DDT could reduce incidences of malaria by killing mosquitoes.
By then, DDT was available for public sale in North America. It was actually marketed as an efficient agricultural and household pesticide, which it actually is. When DDT was introduced to the Canadian market in 1945, an article of the Canadian Geographical Journal, which is now the Canadian Geographic, praised the molecule as being, quote, the only one hope for control of the birdworm. And the article also said that the compound, quote, offer the greatest reason for optimism.
Yet, in the mid-1960s, 20 years after its commercialization, many raised concerns about the impact of DDT on wildlife and on human health. The problem is that DDT doesn't select which insects it kills. DDT kills all sorts of insects, from pests to those we see as beneficial, such as bees. It causes the extinction of insects, birds, and other species, and causes cancer in humans.
In 1972, DDT was banned from agriculture in the US, but remained in use in a variety of states. Canada limited the use of DDT from 1985 and completely suspended it in the late 90s.
And in 2001, all states that signed the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants promised to stop using DDT in agriculture. It's still used, however, in disease vector control. So, for instance, to control mosquito populations in countries affected by malaria and other mosquito-borne diseases.
Today, other pesticides have replaced DDT, such as fipronil and neonicotinoids.
Neonicotinoids.
Neonicotinoids were developed in the 80s and 90s by international companies that are part of the Axe of Evil, such as Shell and Bayer. I own what I said. So the turnover for neonicotinoids represented nearly $2 billion Canadian dollars in 2008.
But they were thought to be effective at only targeting pests. The way they work is that they're coated on seedlings, protecting them during a crucial period of growth, and targeting only insects that directly go for them during that period. But findings show that trace amounts remain in the plant until later stages of development and can be present in the pollen later on in amounts sufficient to cause damage to pollinators, like bees.
And neonicotinoids are thought to be one of the causes behind the decline of bee populations. And we have a little clip to play. Okay, just wait a minute because I need to talk and press buttons at the same time.
Okay, oh no.
Okay, just wait. I finished my sentence. Okay, so here is a clip from a video posted by Science Magazine a couple of years ago, which does a great job at explaining the problem of neonicotinoids, not only on bees, but also for humans. And here you go.
Neonicotinoids are the most widely used insecticide in the world. We know that they have negative effects on bees' health, from growth disorders, reduced efficiency in the immune system, to limiting the lifespan of the queen bee. It's been difficult to pin down sweeping effects on bee populations, but now researchers have found more evidence for another way neonics affect bees, by contaminating their honey. 198 honey samples from around the world were collected through a citizen science project. 75% of the samples tested positive for neonicotinoids. Contamination was prevalent all over the world. This confirms that bees are exposed to neonics in their food. Researchers say the contamination is too low to hurt humans consuming the honey, but that a significantly detrimental effect on bees is likely. What's more, 45% of honey samples showed contamination from multiple types of neonics. The combined effects of these pesticides on bees is just starting to be explored. This global picture of neonicotinoid contamination should be useful to policymakers who are considering the risks and benefits of using the pesticides. Researchers hope these findings will persuade authorities to make publicly available data on neonic usage. Then correlative studies can be conducted to determine the relationship between the use of these pesticides and the current decline of global bee populations.
So there you have it. Where the heck are we? Sorry, I said heck. And the bees are just the ones that everyone kind of makes a fuss about. A recent global review found that rates of decline in populations worldwide could lead to the extinction of over 40% of insect species. That's twice as high as what scientists are anticipating for vertebrate species, such as mammals, birds, and reptiles.
And it's a trend that began in the early 20th century, that accelerated in the 50s and 60s, and has gone nuts in the last couple of decades. For butterflies and moths, so Lepidoptera, and for beetles, Coleoptera, more than half of species reviewed were shown to be declining at a faster rate than usual.
So think about it. There are over 380,000 species of beetles, each one adapted to their specific niche. I mean, that's a lot of species, not even counting the number of individuals. The strength of an ecosystem depends on the diversity of species in it.
With fewer species, an ecosystem's capacity to absorb, change, and survive, more or less intact, is diminished. That's why it's not only worrisome if an entire species is extinct, it's also worrisome if a species becomes extinct regionally. Today, one in six bee species, remember that from last episode we said that there are about 20,000 species of bees, so one in six bee species is regionally extinct. But what does that mean, to be regionally extinct?
Regionally extinct, you say?
Yeah.
It means that a species has disappeared from a certain geographical area, but still exists elsewhere. So great, you might say. You can just replace them with a population from another region. Well, no, you can't. Each regional population has its own special genetic and behavioral package that allows it to survive optimally in that region. Lose one regional population and you might lose a rare resistance to a disease or maybe even to a pesticide that other populations don't have.
And the culprit thought to be the main cause of these extinctions is the intensification of agriculture, fertilizers, pesticides, habitat destruction. Okay, we're supposed
pause for effect.
Huge sigh.
Yeah. So, what a joyful subject. This show was not about solutions journalism. In a post-apocalyptic dystopian future, we might be overpowered by mosquitoes and crop-hungry pests, while butterflies and bees become distant memories in children's tales.
There are, of course, solutions. The first is obviously to take actual action against global warming. This is a special message to all the country's rulers. Going back to more traditional forms of agriculture is also an option. Monoculture has replaced crop rotation with mechanized agriculture and the broad use of pesticides. But crop rotation and the three-fields system are actually good solutions to limit insect damage to crops and to enable the regeneration of soils.
Finally, and obviously, limiting the usage of synthetic and harmful pesticides is necessary to prevent the insect's mass extinction. It also is extremely beneficial to the environment to not remove all weeds and bushes in order to make space for natural ecosystems and biodiversity.
A number of towns and villages in my native country of France have decided to stop cutting the grass and weeds on the roadside because they sustain a number of insects on which birds and bats feed. So there are options. And while they might not reverse the damage that's already been done, it still looks like there is a chance and some hope that we can slow the trends.
So we'll see. You can always stockpile your honey, though you'll have to live with the trace amounts of neonicotinoids. Anyway, that's our show. The end of a semester rush is coming along, and these shows take a long time to prepare, so we must sadly announce that this will be our last show of the semester.
We also won't be around for the holidays, because we'll be busy with all that holiday stuff, decorating trees and eating food. But keep an ear out for us in January. We hope to be back with fresh ideas, maybe a new format we won't be only talking about insects and history, sadly, new subjects, and why not maybe new participants. Before I say so with that, I'm Lucy. I just want to say that I enjoyed this semester a lot. I don't know if people are listening, but it was just great. And with that, I'm Lucy.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. So I'm Martin, and thanks for listening.
Bye.